The topic for the forum tonight is what makes the church in El Salvador a security threat, and more broadly than God and Caesar in Central America. The question really is kind of an interesting question to consider, and I think it's a good way to open up the topic, because it is a fact that the Lutheran Church, for one, is considered a security threat in El Salvador, if one is to judge the behavior towards the church by the informal networks of the government. Officially, the government would not take any responsibility for what is happening, but very clearly they're heavily tied to the army and the death squads. And there have been following things that have taken place in the Lutheran Church. Several of the Lutheran Church workers have been assassinated. Quite a number have been imprisoned and tortured, including Bishop Medardo Gomez. When I was down there a year and a half ago, his youngest daughter was having almost a nervous episode because the latest death threat had been delivered to her to pass on to her dad. She had answered the phone. She was just 10. And so he has a person from the international community with him 24 hours a day, which is a way of protecting him. But he's under surveillance the whole time. The church was bombed in, January?
December.
Their children's facility a year before that was bombed. Their offices have been raided and all records confiscated, which of course sends a chill down any member or contributor's spine, because that then puts them on the suspect list. And so there has, in general, been a fair amount of harassment to a church that is way out of proportion to its size, quite prominent in El Salvador. It really only started in the early 70s at all because of a vision of Medardo Gomez to start the Lutheran Church. He had been refused into the priesthood for the Roman Catholic, and then had gone to a Lutheran school, become a Lutheran, decided he wanted to start the Lutheran Church there, and they've been growing by leaps and bounds and have a reputation for a number of things, which I think can be addressed by the panel members to kind of get things going. But it is a fact that it is considered a threat, at least in some people's eyes. And there are other churches that seem to also do that. So the question, what makes it a threat? And then I hope that beyond considering that, we can go more broadly into the question of the relationship between God and Caesar in Central America, because it seems that questions are being raised not only for Central American governments, but certainly for our government, the church in our government. What I thought would, to kick this off in a customary fashion, we have some people that have been in Central America somewhat recently, and unfortunately Kent Burgess, we were hoping, would make it, but he was not. Kent has some interesting stories to tell, and if any of you happen to be in the village for longer than I'm going to be, I'm going tomorrow. He did some rather foolish and hair-raising things, but went out into the countryside at 3 in the morning getting by the armed guards, because it was said that they often sleep at the bridges at 3, and so he was in villages and actually saw guerrillas. His wife had reason to be very, very worried about him when he was gone. Fortunately, she didn't know. I'm sorry he isn't here tonight. He's going to be back tomorrow.
Yeah.
You were?
Yeah.
You're crazy, Jackie. But at any rate, I just found out from our discussion this morning, is it Selby?
Mm-hmm.
Has been in Central America on a number of occasions, including El Salvador. So we thought, not that they're speaking out of an expert mode, that wasn't the understanding, but just give a personal response to that question, and then let's just open it up for a discussion and see what we might come up with. Kathy, would you like to go first? And then we'll have Vicki and Selby and Jack.
My experience with Central America started in Mexico, where I studied with the Center for Global Education. And during this time, which was from September through December, part of my personal focus was focusing on El Salvador, knowing that I would be hopefully going there in January and part of February working with a human rights organization called Comadres. So I did a lot of studying during this time. I did a lot of studying with the base Christian communities in Mexico. My Mexican mother was a leader of her base Christian community. And then finally I was able to get my visa to El Salvador after about 5 trips to the embassy in Mexico City. So I got into El Salvador about the 28th or so of December, shortly after the bomb had destroyed the Lutheran church. And I started working with the Comadres that Monday after New Year's Day or Tuesday or something like that. So most of my time was with the Comadres, which was founded with Oscar Romero and a few mothers who were concerned about their families being destroyed and their sons and husbands and daughters being taken from them and finding them on the streets with no identity left because they had been destroyed by acid and different stories. And so they decided to come together as a collective of mothers. This is how their story started. And then Romero was assassinated in 1980, and they continued their struggle more as a human rights organization, I would say now, than a religious affiliation. When I was in El Salvador, I spoke with Phil Dexheimer, who was here a while ago, and as a person who had been working with the Lutheran Church, he was able to give me many insights on the Lutheran experience in El Salvador. And he described how the base Christian communities, unlike the communities in Nicaragua or Mexico, aren't so focused these days on simply biblical study. They have found it necessary to move into the human rights organizations, into the unions, into any sort of organization so they can make their spirituality extremely tangible. So that it is not something where they're just simply studying and talking, but it's something that is making a visible difference in their lives. So I can see this working with the mothers. They're not able to go to church because they work Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday. On Sundays, they go to the prisons to visit different political prisoners who are there unjustly. So they don't have time to even rest themselves, let alone spend a whole day at church. And I see that as very sad. And I see that it is too bad for them. I see that the Lutheran Church is able to give people a spiritual base as well as that extra push politically and organizational-wise. But I don't think that everyone in their spiritual journey is able to connect the two as vividly as Gomez has done, and other churches, the Episcopalians and the Baptists and the Catholics, are often able to do this, the praxis that we often talk about if you've studied liberation theology. But my friends didn't have time for that.
Try to probably just go a couple minutes here on each one because we've got 3 here. Selby, would you like to respond?
Well, I think the short answer to the question of the forum for me is that there are important aspects of the church, the Protestant churches, and of course the Roman Catholic Church, which is the predominant faith. There that read the Bible and take it at its word to exercise what's called a preferential option for the poor, is that Jesus' message calls us to act on behalf of the poor and the oppressed. And so the elements of the church, the priests and the ministers and the in some cases archbishops of the Roman Catholic Church and of the Protestant churches who have taken that message literally are run up into very powerful interests that Peter described earlier today. The rich landowners, what's called the oligarchy in El Salvador, and who in collusion with U.S. business and political interests are maintaining power and economic control at the expense of the majority of the people who are severely impoverished and who seek to change things. So there's a revolutionary process unfolding in Central America that of people taking power, of students, of teachers, of social workers, of many of whom are people of faith and who are acting out of their faith, who want to who want to be in charge of their own future. And this revolutionary process is very much a Christian-based process. And it's very brutally opposed by the military in El Salvador and by the U.S. government that supports it and arms it. Just to say a little bit more about Medardo Gomez, I've worked for an organization who was sponsored by him and has provided some of the escort protection for him. And for Clem Andres, done work similar to Kathy's, it's called Peace Brigades International. And what I've heard of Gomez's words is that he says it's, as Christians, we're called to spread the word of God. But in order for people to hear the word of God, they must be fed, they must have a voice in their own future, and they must be free to exercise their human rights. And until those conditions exist, the church has to address those conditions in spreading the word of God. And just for saying that and for acting on that, for acting on behalf of refugees, of unemployed people, and others, Gomez has faced this oppression, that this incredible response from a power structure that's very threatened by the poor having a voice in their own destiny. So that's the short answer, and it's important to say that the whole church, not the whole Roman Catholic Church nor the whole Protestant Church, has considered a security risk. For example, there's fundamentalist Protestants from North America who pour millions of dollars into missionary work in Central America. They're very much aligned with the interests of the military and the U.S. government, and preach a gospel of passivity and acceptance of oppression and waiting for the second coming kind of fundamentalism. And they're not considered a security risk, nor are many kind of waffling bishops and clergy, who have not really taken a stand for the poor in Central America. But the church has much to be proud of there as well.
Vicki, would you like
to? I think that was really well said. I don't have too much to add to that. I would just say a couple things sort of out of my own experience. My experience, like Kathy's, began in Mexico, and I spent some time in base communities in Mexico, in Nicaragua, and a little bit in El Salvador. And the people in the base Christian communities truly are people that are taking the Bible at its word and really studying it and looking at their own lives and trying to live out their faith. And there's an incredible energy and inspiration that is coming out of those base communities that is really fueling a lot of faith-based political action. And I think that's where the government in El Salvador and our own government bases a lot of its fears, that political action that's coming out of those faith-based commitments. You reminded me of a quote that I heard in Nicaragua in one of the base communities, and that quote said that between Christianity and revolution, there is no contradiction. Mm-hmm. And that's a pretty radical thing to say, and our government would certainly perceive that as very threatening. So I think that to really analyze the threat that our government perceives, we need to take a real good look at what liberation theology states. And our government in 1980 issued a report called the Santa Fe Report out of the Council for Inter-American Security that basically labels liberation theology as a security threat to the United States. And basically because of what you were saying in terms of giving a voice to the poor people, that it's a theology that, that claims good news to the poor, freedom to the captives, and liberation to the oppressed. It doesn't maintain the status quo. It doesn't maintain our economic interests in those countries. And I think that's the bottom line, is our economic interests. And liberation theology is upsetting to our empire and to the oligarchy in El Salvador. Just another quote from a man in El Salvador, Jose Antonio Rodriguez Port, who a year ago when I was there, he was the executive director of the Chamber of Commerce. And then when I was there again in the spring, he had been named secretary to the president, and a week after taking office was assassinated. And he was a very key figure in the new Arena government. And we had the opportunity to meet with him a year ago in August. And this is what he says about the church. He says, the church is trying to put out lifesavers for the guerrilla because the church is losing power with the people. The church is trying to put the guerrilla in power. And so he very clearly aligns the church with the guerrilla movement and with the Indians.
Jackie, and then we'll open up for
ditto from what everyone else has said, which is kind of nice and affirming to hear. I wonder what pair of glasses you have on when you see such a situation. But repeatedly, we heard stories of priests and church people who perhaps came there out of somewhat of the conservative background. I know Oscar Romero was a very strong conservative when he was placed in that office. And repeatedly heard of how people had been converted by their work with the poor to a new theology, and feeling that they were called to the gospel in a way that they had not ever heard it before. And truly, that can be felt in the spirit of the communities. The place that Peter talked about that we went to for 3 days was a community where one of the volunteer workers who we were visiting worked and lived. And the reason that Kent and I were able to go is that the group of people who had come down from her church to visit her, one of them was a member of the National Guard here in the United States. And she refused to let this woman go with her out to this this village because she did not want to risk her own relationship with these people out there by bringing in a U.S. military person, the potential for them finding out. So we got to go instead, which meant, as Peter said, getting up in the middle of the night and being stopped and asked to get out of the Jeep and checked by, looked like 15 or 16-year-olds with M16s pointed. And, you know, ended up being able to go, even though we did not have what are called safe conduct passes, which allow us to go out into those areas. The morale within the Army there is not very good because of the forced recruitment that goes on. And to be honest, the people, the military who stopped us, almost felt intimidated by us, felt embarrassed that they had to stop us, and then proceeded to let us go on and said, well, when you get to this village, be sure and get this safe conduct pass, which everybody there knew that was not the proper procedure for getting it, but we were allowed to go anyway. And this village was celebrating its 1-year anniversary of being returning from Misa Grande in Honduras, where they had been refugees, and were celebrating that 1-year return where they had established this community and cooperative, which was very alive, which probably many people would label communists, but it felt more democratic than what I have felt sometimes even at Holden. But anyway, I think in answer to the question, the U.S. Embassy would say that these villages are made up of refugees who escaped to Honduras due to the war, and frightening, terrible stories of that whole process by the military. And there in Honduras were propagandized by Cubans or Nicaraguans about communism, and then they had to be let back because the U.S. the United Nations law or whatever that says the Salvadoran government has to let these people back into the country, see them as sources of guerrilla support. We did see guerrillas in that village. Many of them are probably family members of the people who do live in those villages. View them as a threat. And I guess, you know, the question about, you know, Kathy was saying how spiritual, I think there were places, other places where the community started with a priest who started to spend time with the poor and started just simply reading the Bible, you know, with these poor people, and began to develop a sense of community and cooperative sharing of resources that now have come to be perceived as a threat economically to the haves, and the have-nots are inspired. But their courage and their hope and their faith is something that just cannot be squelched by $1.5 million of U.S. military every day. So,
well, the question, of course, of the forum is what makes it a security risk, and we might address that. Things that the panelists have also raised is the question, has the church, these aspects of the church, been used by Marxist-Leninists or communists? Are they, you know, kind of unwilling, unwitting dupes? I suppose, let's just throw this open to viewpoints here. And I hope we have some diversity here. Anybody like to comment?
Well, I'll ask a question of Jackie or one of the other women. To what extent did you sense that women were directly involved as being part of the threat? That is, if there is a liberation theology being proclaimed, if there is a sharing of ideas and power and so on, is that, and I'm assuming that involves the women, so to what extent is that significant, or is it more broad-based than that?
I worked with a women's organization, Comadres, which was started with mothers and with Oscar Romero. All of the people in power in this organization are women, and they share their power collectively. There is a president and a vice president, and then there are different chairs, chair of propaganda, chair of treasury, all these different things they need to do to keep their organization going. So in this organization, which I would say was inspired by the base Christian communities in its early days, these women have found their voice and are using it and are a major threat to the government. Oftentimes you'll see pictures, fuzzy pictures, of a woman dressed up in a guerrilla uniform and of a woman wearing a comadre outfit. They kind of cover their heads and try and cover their eyes so people can't see who they are. And they'll say, look, these people are the same, a guerrilla and a comadre, and interlink the rebel forces with the popular movement in a way that just is not valid. And the government will try and twist reality. So I would say that the gospel has given these women a profound voice that is very dangerous to the status quo.
I'm wondering if it was broader, it was primarily women or what?
However they,
yeah.
I would say that that was a question I asked myself a lot when I was down there, and really felt a distinction between the urban and rural women a lot. I told the story this morning of a woman who was involved in a lot of women's rights and organizing labor unions for teachers, and a woman who was abducted and murdered by the death squad, and was probably a very active feminist that came out of a spiritual base. But in the villages and in the rural areas, I still, although the women were the ones of hospitality primarily, they were still also primarily the caretakers of children. And I think they were very involved, whenever we spoke to that, what they call their committee directiva, which is the organ, the group who sort of are the leaders of the cooperative, there was always equally as many women as there were men. So there are some role changes that are certainly still very traditional and others that are.
What's the role of the Roman Catholic Church in El Salvador? I mean, you think of them as greatly outnumbered the Lutherans. They got some bishops who are like Gomez?
They had not bishops, but they had a lot of priests, I think. Many more North American or European, wouldn't you say?
I think I could speak to that unless, would you like to?
Oh, go ahead.
The Roman Catholic Church was heavily involved in the Christian Democrat movement that was inaugurated in the early 60s in Central and Latin America as a kind of Roman Catholic Christian response to the felt threat of communism. And it was out of this movement that was spawned a political party which had really the principles of Duarte and the UNGO in the FMLN. What happened there, however, was that when that party came into power, the military simply nullified the election, shot a few people, and they fled, and that was where the revolution really began. But there was a historical tie, and so I think when I was there a year and a half ago and Duarte was in power, it was noted that the primary leadership of the Roman Catholic Church was pretty friendly with Duarte, and that people were seeing as the voice of the Catholic Church in protest was much more muted from when it was when Romero. And so I think it's one of the reasons why the very small Lutheran church, Gomez is kind of seen, is coming to be seen almost as a modern day Romero, despite the fact he's from a very, very small church, the Lutheran church. I think that there's been a little bit of a vacuum. At the same time, I also visited the setup within the Roman Catholic Church to investigate human rights abuses, talk with Maria Hernandez, and they would tend to probably be a voice that people in power have wanted to silence because they've done a very methodical follow-up on human rights abuses and have some pretty good statistics, and one of the things they were saying is it hasn't gotten better. And the government had a real strong need to say yes, it has, because obviously the people back at home in the United States would need to feel that it was in order to keep supporting the congressman to vote for the aid. And so there was a contrast there. But I would say the Catholic Church is probably divided between the establishment and then the problem of the base Christian communities, which have tended to almost be almost a counter movement within the Catholic Church. And that division, I think, runs.
The successor to Oscar Romero, who Jackie mentioned, who's a real martyr in El Salvador, killed in March 1980 in the middle of a homily in which he called for an end to the killing, for soldiers to lay down their arms and not oppress their brothers and sisters. And, his successor, Rivera y Demas, is kind of cautious for good reason. You know, he likes to keep living and. I don't know in detail what the Salvadorian Catholic Church does, but it's kind of a cautiously tries to do some refugee work and so forth in some ways, and it keeps a low to moderate profile politically usually. And from outside, from the Spanish Catholic Church and from the North American Church, I'd say that the folks who've really gotten in there that I've seen have been the Mary Knowles and the Jesuits, you know, who get out in the grassroots communities and identify with the liberation theology and the situation of poor people in Salvador.
I was going to mention the Jesuit volunteers we had contact with, but also at this celebration in the village that we were at, they had a mass that day. And John Cortina was the name of the priest who officiated, and he is a colleague of John Sobrino, if any of you have read any of his stuff on liberation theology. in San Salvador. So, yeah, I think there are a lot of Catholics doing certain things, but whether it's at the archbishop level or at the sort of sanction level is different.
Question over here.
Question and comment. My basic question, and I think that the threat to the church or the threat that the church causes as perceived by the Salvadorian government is, I wonder to what extent it's linked because, I wonder to what extent the church is linked to the guerrillas. And that's another why it's perceived as a threat. And my my reason for asking this question is because liberation theology has stated in various texts that it is okay then to perform this liberation, to enact the liberation, to bring up arms. And of course, we have a long tradition of the just war theory that says that in certain situations, war is, and killing of other people are acceptable and the way to go in God's eyes. And so I think that the warmongers or the San Salvadorian government could perceive the church from those two perspectives as being equivalent with the guerrilla movement. And if they do anything to be supportive of the guerrilla movement, just by standing with the poor, obviously standing with the people who are their only hope for liberation, makes me think that it's logical that the church should be attacked in that situation. And that brings me to another question, which is questioning religious support of war, even in this type of a situation, as being biblical.
Would anybody like to respond to that statement?
I guess I respond just a little bit in commenting on the first part of that, and that is that El Salvador is such an incredibly polarized country that in the government's eyes, you're either for them or against them. And if you're not openly for them and supportive of government policies, then you're in the other camp. And I think that is at times how the church can be viewed, and that you're right, you know, that they do take a stand with the poor, and that the poor hold their hopes with the liberation forces to some degree. Mm-hmm. And it's real clear in talking with the military and people in the government that when they can, they try to align the church with the guerrilla movement because it's to their advantage to do that. The church is speaking against the status quo, and that's threatening.
I think it's very important that the Lutheran Church in El Salvador has very clearly said it is not taking sides.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was that I never heard one group that we talked to, with the exception of an educator at a Jesuit university who apparently has a reputation as a person that all sides can go to find out what's really going on in the country. He was the only one who spoke freely. Everyone else was even afraid to use the word FMLN.
Mm-hmm.
For fear that they were being bugged and this would somehow be used as evidence that they were lying themselves. In contrast, the fact that in Nicaragua somebody could openly say in Managua that they were for the Contras. I mean, there was much more political freedom of speech there than here. But so I think it's important that the link, I think, is in my experience is an unfair link, even though one could understand how it could be made. I don't think most of the churches are by any means. I think they're really trying to call for negotiated peace rather than saying we're for the FMLN. Yeah. Now, obviously, that would be for good reason.
It's very polarized, as Vicki said, but it's also many facets of the process there. Most people in El Salvador want things to change. And want the people who are in power not to be in power. I mean, the people who are politically active and so forth. But only a small number of those are the so-called guerrilla movement. And of course, that's mostly what we hear about because our media in the United States is geared to war. But that's only one facet of a revolutionary process. And there's other people who sympathize with that but don't take up arms. And there's people who don't necessarily sympathize with that but also want there to be a revolution or basic change. So there's, but I would say the military is a minority movement in one way, and the majority movement are people who form organizations like Comadres and the students and unemployed workers and teachers and so forth, who demonstrate in the streets and agitate for more political freedom and more political dialogue and for economic changes. And that's really where the church has been most active. But of course, all these different things, both nonviolent as well as violent, threaten the power structure. And so they get lumped together, you know, put the communist smear label on that and kill in the name of stopping communism.
Let me raise a question, though, that you raised for our discussion, because this has been one of the big, I suppose there have been two big issues that have centered around liberation theology. One is the influence of Marxist thought on social analysis as part of that process, and the other is the willingness of some liberation theologians to recognize violence as an option, although I think it's fair to say that there are some pacifist liberation theologians. But what you raised a good question in terms of Christian viewpoints on war, etc. What are some of your views on that? How might we view liberation theology? Maybe nobody wants to respond.
You're not a real American unless you own an assault rifle.
You have problems with liberation theology for that recognition of the possibility of violence. Would that be correct?
Well, I'm a pacifist.
Yeah, I kind of gathered that.
An active pacifist.
Mm-hmm. Is there anybody else here that would share your view?
I'm kind of share that view. Even conventional war, I think, is just so terrible that Christians, including Lutherans, who used to talk about just wars and unjust wars, I think Lutherans would be hard-pressed to find justifiable wars.
I thought we didn't sanction that, but that was changed. Has it been made into a church statement or anything? War is not sanctioned anymore by the church, to say that. Is it?
I was not aware that the official, I don't think that the Lutherans' position is officially pacifist, no.
No, but no, I mean, we don't support the just war the way they used to.
Well, the criteria for the justifiable war is really broken down when it comes to a nuclear armament race.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
On no counts can you justify a war in that arena. But.
And then the Pope came out to condemn liberation theology and really strengthen the conservative or big part of our government that he was supporting all this and really gave them support. And I'm sure he validated the Catholics.
But I don't think that liberation theology should be thrown out on account of this one option that's being. I think that they're using war as a means to the end, and I don't think the end of a just liberated. The people who are oppressed having oppression taken off of them, that should be thrown out. That's still a worthy goal. And I think that the groups that you were describing and the way that they are going about it, though it will bring on the suffering that we have been talking about in our Bible study, if you are true to God's word, it's going to bring on suffering, but that the suffering will eventually bring about the empowerment and the resurrection and change.
Most groups that go down there, I thought in the name of the church from here at least, or that are working in Liberty, to come down there in a peaceful way to educate, to feed, to clothe, and to work with the people and hope that this will make the change and try to do that first. I know I heard of Mary Knowles' sister talk, who said to protect the right for them to go down there, they won't talk anymore about the stories because they wouldn't get visas from our government to go again.
Mm-hmm.
So to get around it, they just never tell their story. because then they can't be accused of criticism. But I thought, so here's the tension on that side too, so we don't even hear more of the true story. So they can go down and do their peaceful education, which is threatening to them.
They're under threat, yes, but I think also some of those people who are going down there, and they're put in a real bind because they're asked to be able to make the, some of them are making a distinction too, and this is true. I'm from a Mennonite background, and Mennonite workers in El Salvador. It's very difficult, I think, for them to make this distinction between the pacifist response and accepting the fact that this country's at war and hoping, aiding that war effort in some whatever small way they do. But there's a tension there for those workers.
The delegation that we went with was all of the MCC workers, and the chairman of the MCC board accompanied us out to this village intending to meet with leaders more or less of the FMLN to talk about whether the workers who are there are at risk in being in that conflicted area.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a very big question for the international people there.
Mm-hmm.
In, you know, whether they're, even though they maintain an objective stance and are not politically aligned, and they you know, say they're there to be there for the people who are asking them to be there. It's a very difficult question.
One of the questions, I guess, that this whole topic raises eventually, I suppose, so that we're not only looking at it from a distance, is the question, what ought to be the response of the American church to this situation as we understand it? And this is particularly important when we look at the relationship of the American church to the American government. And perhaps we could have some views expressed. Or concerns that you think ought to be raised, questions.
Well, during my time in January, one of the most positive things to happen in the newspapers were these campo pagados, where the different organizations were able to put in their statement in this one newspaper called El Mundo, the world. So you were able to see different statements from the comadres, from the group that Vicky worked with, and from all these different popular organizations, as well as more right-wing organizations. But oftentimes you would find statements from U.S. church organizations. I remember seeing Elma Witt's name on one of these, and a few different church, prominent church folks in the U.S. And that's a real important inspiration for these people, to see that they are very directly supported by their sisters and brothers in the church in the U.S. That it's not just a lot of talk, that there are letters being written to Duarte, that there are letters being sent in telegrams, and we know that this person has been captured. We demand her to be let out of prison, and we know this is unjust. That there are statements like this being made by the U.S. church, and I wonder how we can make this a broader, more collective effort from all congregations. And how can we make sister churches a daily occurrence? Because that is really the spark that keeps them going. One of the comments one of the older mothers made was, here we have God and internationals. That is our hope.
Huh. Let me ask you a question. Are you talking about, when we're talking about congregations getting involved in here in the States, and what exactly?
There are different ways. There's letter writing, emergency alerts.
That's what I'm saying, nationally.
Yeah, but the churches need to do it too. Amnesty International isn't always fast enough. isn't always quick enough and is a secular voice. They need to hear it from the church. They also need aid, tangible, medical aid, educational aid, things like that. And they need us to talk to our congresspeople, tell them our stories that we've heard. They need us to talk to President Bush. Well, why don't you just go up and tell Bush what's happening, and of course he'll stop. It's not that easy, but that's what they told me to do.
I think what Bush said.
I'll tell you what Slade Gordon said.
What did he say?
He said the whole U.S. rhetoric line.
Yeah. Okay, right. Here. Okay, go on.
I think one of the things that certainly the churches in America could do, which, you know, may have just as much effect as supporting the people there, who are in many ways, we're encouraging them to oppose U.S. government policy in the guise of their local government, because our policies and our cash is supporting dictatorial regimes in Central America. But since we're citizens of the United States, our church should be attempting to educate the other citizens of the United States who are unwittingly supporting U.S. government and economic policies that are oppressing people in other countries. Most of us don't think that we're doing that. So I would see it as effective, maybe more effective, for those in our churches who know what's going on down there to try to educate the American people through educational propaganda campaigns to make them aware so that they don't support our government policies.
Yeah, I was thinking that just to relate something that is going on in our congregation right now, and I've been actively involved and interested in doing that, and I just kind of started before I left, and that's a big project that we have. And you know, I go back is to basically, with the help of Amnesty International, just, you know, get actively involved in a project like that, in which you know, using the same system basically, but it's like a lot of letter writing. And sponsoring people on a personal, you know, basis and things like that. And I strongly believe the congregation should get involved in that type of, you know, work. And just to relate something also, I don't think it has to do only with, you know, Central America or South Africa for that matter, you know, because, I mean, I guess a lot of congregations are involved in that type of things. But even within the United States, you have a lot of, you know, situations in which the church has a lot of power. We're talking about that tonight, and I think that the political system in the United States is so polarized between, you know, these two parties that it doesn't offer so much, you know, voice to minorities or, you know, other type of, you know, I would say minorities at many levels. And I think that the church can have a really, you know, good stand. And I think on a personal level that going into lobbying is very important. And I think that, I don't know whether the church can do that, but I don't know, that's what I think I'm gonna look into on a personal level. I know that, you know, there is this, you know, such a concern in many, many congregations just to go out and go to Washington and be there and just really, I mean, become a pressure group, I mean, lobbying group. And I don't know what the church can do about it, whether the church, the Lutheran church and in general, other churches are willing to, you know, to take that step.
I think that getting information from a lot of different sources is important. So I would encourage you to, people in churches, just to play organized forums you know, there's lots of people who've returned from Central America. There's Salvadoran refugees living in sanctuary and in U.S. churches and synagogues who can come and speak. Or you can go yourself. There's some excellent organizations that have been organized that for as little as a week to 2 weeks that churches often subsidize, even individual churches can subsidize to send people to come back and report to their congregations about it. There's also some real good church sources of information and news about Central America through the American Friends Service Committee, the Mennonite Central Committee, and National Council of Churches. I'm sure there's Lutheran sources too. And it's kind of, you have to reach for that kind of information and firsthand reports, and everybody's here tonight since it's reaching, you know, going to that extra meeting. But it'll really open up a dimension of the situation there that you just won't get from the U.S. government or the media. And I think that out of that, the avenues Kathy and others have described, that you may be drawn to one of those to become active on this, because it concerns us a lot as U.S. citizens. We have a special responsibility. Our government is over half the national budget of Salvador is our tax dollars. And you know, there's a historical relationship there that's in the process of changing, and we all need to be informed about it, and not just take Bush's word for it, or not just take our word for it either. I don't know, you can.
And we need more and more, because I'll tell you, an incident in our church, Crystal in the air, is an old knight, graduate seminary, ordained minister, took a trip down and gave a slideshow at our church, told the same story at the end. And maybe this is good, this is the kernel I'm starting to think. The question was, well, should we believe you or our government? And she was floored. She went home just with the rest. She'd given this marvelous presentation with these same stories. And of course, maybe the fact that they asked the question is the first step. But they were confused, but they just thought, well, you know, should we believe you when our government says this? And I think a lot of the American public and in our churches either have never heard the stories, and so we need the education, or they really are confused about doubting our government.
You know, a lot of church people cannot conceive that their government would do anything wrong.
And a church person, they wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that would have been nice in this forum, but I realize that perhaps we're all, many of us are of the same mind, and if you aren't, maybe you didn't dare say anything, but a little dialogue of differing viewpoints, I think, is very, very helpful. I don't think we should underestimate the enormous pain that a person needs to go through to come to the recognition. I suppose it's like the pain of seeing that one's parents aren't perfect. You know, you've always grown up with the idea that your country somehow operates on a higher level, and that somehow it's disloyal to think that it doesn't. And I think that's a legitimate question. Who should we view? And of course, the quick question comes about, well, aren't you just getting a line? You had a limited experience. You know, why are we to believe you? And that's a legitimate question. So not only is it a legitimate question on the standpoint of who do we believe, but it's also, we have to recognize the very painful dynamic of coming to the point where you feel that maybe your country hasn't been right, it hasn't chosen the prudent course. And I think we shouldn't underestimate the fact of the tremendous political liability of anybody in elected office to being perceived as soft on communist, even if that has very little to do with the situation. If the FMLN won, the president and anybody that did anything that appeared to be soft would bear a terrible political liability, because most people do see it precisely in those terms. And so I think this whole matter of educating to the fact, maybe we have to take seriously the question, dealing with the question, is the church being used by the communists? Maybe for somebody that's thought a lot about it, you realize that we've got to go way beyond that question. But that's a good initial question. and one that people in our day and age in our country tend to think. That's the first question. It's us against them, which is exactly what low-intensity warfare wants us to see the world as, because then you can make it simple.
So, I mean, to show you how involved this is, though, about 2 years earlier, we had a pastor come to our church and lead a forum, and he had been there on the same type of trip for several weeks, and was sent by the State Department. Then they were invited to Washington for a critique to present to the State Department, and he got down to Washington, and for 2 days all they did was state the U.S. government's position and tell them that they really didn't understand the situation. And here they thought they were being asked to go down there and look at and come and report back. And he said it was so exasperating he couldn't believe it.
You
have the same thing?
Yeah, a whole room full of people, including some real authorities from Central America who've been talked to instead of listened to.
So it's nice to say we can write letters, but when you get right down there and talk to them face to face and they still won't even admit anything, it's pretty difficult.
What would have been earlier on, thinking about revolutions and things, and then I was transferring this back to the Russian Revolution and wondering what position of how we'd be discussing this if we'd gone to visit the peasants in Russia under the Tsar, and who we would have felt that we wanted to support in that kind of situation. And when you're talking about oppressed peoples, one does tend to lose sight of political ideologies and say, well, you know, who's supporting personal rights in this situation?
I think these are important questions, and there's, for example, some people that, for example, have supported U.S. policy saying we recognize there's a problem, but we don't want a communist regime in there, we want a democracy. Because in the long run, we feel, for our political interests, etc.
I don't think we have to agree with what Medardo Gomez is doing or the FMLN is doing or anybody else is doing in El Salvador to say that we respect the right of the Salvadoran people to work out their own destiny. Mm-hmm. And the United States government is a major impediment to that happening. You know, I mean, it's like we fought a revolution, in the 1770s, and it's very important to us that, suppose all of Europe, by analogy, had come in and said, we're going to stop you, the colonies, from making this revolution and determining your own destiny. We would have been furious, and it might have been a struggle that took decades and decades and decades instead of a few years. I guess there are probably people in Great Britain who thought we were puppets of the French, because the French did help us. So, but it's a basic right. I think the main job is to get our government out of there, and possibly to provide material aid or part of the mission of the church.
And Gomez was asked that question, I think actually by Kent, about whether the U.S. should withdraw, completely. And we're still unclear right now whether Medardo understood the question, but he said that he did not think the U.S. should withdraw completely. He said, we will go elsewhere for the aid. There's no doubt about that. His request was that the aid be conditioned only for in favor of human rights and a negotiated settlement, that should be behind what we ask our government to do.
I think we're drawing to a close of the hour. I would like to, unless there was somebody that had their hand up, I'd like to share something that was said to me by a person by the name of Marion Nicholson, who works in the Washington, D.C. office and is pretty close to the and helps represent the Lutheran Church when it does take positions in various areas. She told me that Congress people really appreciate getting letters, and if a letter is written by a person that reflects the person took the time to sit down and write it on a political position, to get 4 or 5 letters from different people makes quite an impression. And she pointed that out. and so we should not underestimate the fact. And that many times she said one instance in particular, a congressperson really felt that he should vote in this way, but he was getting an enormous number of letters from, in this case, a very, very conservative, and was so grateful when there were finally came some letters, because he was able to then say that I have constituents that want this. And I think that perhaps the people in the mainstream, and I think it's a critique of liberals, have oftentimes been far more willing to be pure and defeated than right and than winning and pragmatic. And and I don't know that this is a liberal conservative issue. I think this is fundamentally an issue of being faithful to the gospel and of being concerned about peace and not of buying into an increasingly cynical philosophy that's trying to keep order, and that is through terribly, terribly violent means, secret police. The thing that frightens me, I suppose, the most is that we have seemed to now endorse on a covert level the very thing that we for so many years were saying we deplored about communism. And I think that has the distinct risk of eating away and destroying our souls if we allow it to continue and don't, as citizens, say that we must use our ingenuity to seek other solutions than what we're now using. Mm-hmm. I am not being neutral in this forum. It's my last one. But thank you so much.
Thank you.